It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
There's a traditional American folk song called Someone's in the Kitchen with Dinah. Well, if we update the song and link it to Las Vegas, it would be called Someone's in the Restaurant with Al. And that would refer to my guest, Al Mancini, who has covered the Las Vegas dining scene for numerous publications since 2003. He's co-host of the popular Food and Loathing podcast. It's available on multiple platforms. Creator of the Las Vegas dining guide app, Neon Feast, which features recommendations from chefs, critics, insiders, and influencers, and available on app stores for both Apple and Android. And he will be a special guest on Milk Street Radio, live in Las Vegas, hosted by Milk Street founder Christopher Kimball at the Beverly Theater, June 10th at 6 p.m. And you can follow Al on X and on Instagram at Al Mancini Vegas. And Al, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So what's with you in food?
What's with me in food? I don't know. You know, I got sucked into writing about food because I love Las Vegas chefs and restaurateurs so much. I came here to cover entertainment. I had covered rock and roll most of my young journalistic career. I was constantly out here in Vegas covering bands and performers. And I came out here for ABC News Radio to cover entertainment. And I loved it. But I started writing about food on the side because you want to stay local. And the more I got to know the chefs in Las Vegas, the more I realized they were some of the most creative, exciting people that I had ever met in my life among all the artists I've interviewed, all the scenes I'd reported on. And I knew that I was here in Las Vegas at a very special time for culinary. I felt like the same way that if you were in Seattle when the grunge scene was taking off, or, you know, if you were in New York for the birth of punk or something like that, I felt like being in Las Vegas and the beginning of the 21st century really was witnessing an amazing transformation of a culinary scene. And I decided to make my career about writing about it and documenting it. And I've been so lucky. All these chefs have welcomed me into their world, told me their stories, trusted me to share their stories. So it's been a fun ride.
And you're right, the food aspect of Las Vegas really didn't have much impact in the 20th century. Sure, you had one or two good restaurants. You may have had a chef or two, but it really, the explosion, you hit it at the sweet spot. You really did in terms of the timing.
Yeah. And when you, if you've covered the arts ever, if you've been around artists ever in your life, you know that once in a while, you'll stumble across a scene that's really special, that's really at a very unique moment in time. And, you know, and I would tell my friends, as recently as 6 or 7 years ago, I'd tell my friends, appreciate this, enjoy what we're seeing right now, because times like this don't come again. They will build something that's bigger and better. But to be there for the moment, that gestation period is just so, it moves you inside. It really does. And it's exciting to be a part of. So I feel very lucky.
Was there one magical moment that hit you and that's when you realize you're going to focus on the culinary scene rather than just entertainment or other factors in Las Vegas?
Well, I think the first hints were when I just saw how all the chefs were helping each other out, right? How these chefs were moving off of the strip. They decided they wanted to stay in Las Vegas instead of going back to their celebrity chef bosses' restaurants in New York or San Francisco. They decided to set up shop off the strip. So I was just getting very, very excited seeing that creativity, seeing that hunger in the chefs. And then I will tell you, there were a few tragedies that hit, and I saw how the Las Vegas culinary community came together. For one restaurant critic's injury, Max Jacobson, for Kerry Simon's illness. But then again, you know, after the shooting on October 1st, I mean, I have seen this town come together and seen the chefs lead it. And really, it was those crises that made me say, wow, I want to give back to these people because I see the way that they're giving back to their community.
Yeah, and I think you're going to be in that scene for a long time to come. Just to lighten the moment, have you ever cut a pie with your hair?
Have I ever cut a pie? No. Okay. You know, it's the older I get, the easier it is to spike, but the less it holds up because there's a lot less hair up there right now. This is the ultimate comb over. It's just a comb up, basically.
For those just listening, go and check out a picture of Al and you'll see what we're talking about or watch the video on YouTube. Al has always had a very distinctive style. It's been part of you for how long now at this point? 25 years?
I've had some form of a mohawk since I moved to Las Vegas, although it used to be a really long jet black mohawk that I combed back and it went all the way down like to my butt, basically in the back. And then after dyeing your hair black for like 30 years straight or something ridiculous, you can't get any other colors in there. So I just told my guy, you know what, man, start bleaching the roots. Once they get about an inch long, cut everything else out. And then from now on till the day I die, I'm going to come to you and you can give me whatever colors you want. So I don't know what color I'm getting in my hair anymore. It's just a new excitement thing that I'm trying to have fun. Man, I'm 56 years old. I'm surprised I still have hair. Let's have fun with what I got left. And, you know, I will tell you, I started it with the weird hair, the long mohawk. When I was working in rock and roll, I was on a lot of red carpets and I needed these rock stars who I only saw once a year. I certainly wasn't friends with them, but they knew me and I wanted them to come over and talk to me. And that has carried over into the restaurant industry to the point where the late, great Joël Robuchon, one of the greatest chefs that ever lived, he loved my hair. He came up to me and had a picture taken with me every time he was in Las Vegas. I have a picture of him kissing the side of my head. Now, look, I don't know. I didn't speak French. Maybe he was making fun of me. I don't care. It could be Joël Robuchon. He could make fun of me all he wants. That just the fact that he wanted to hang out with me was cool. So it works. People remember it.
No, that's excellent. And it's your personal brand. So it works for everybody in that sense. Well, let's talk about a couple of items that I mentioned in the intro, starting, I think, well, let's do it in your podcast first, which is called Food and Loathing. And I remember when you started it, and it's always a little bit tough when you first start a podcast. It's not the same as a radio show. So was it challenging in the beginning?
You know, the podcast for me has always been, when I left the Review Journal, I wanted a place that would be a no pressure zone, right? I knew I was going to be starting Neon Feast, restaurant guide, my first startup, being an entrepreneur. I knew there'd be all this crazy pressure, business decisions, et cetera. And I wanted a place where I could just talk about food. So for me, the podcast has always been the place where I just cut loose. Don't worry about how many listeners we have, any of that stuff. Just get chef friends on and we talk about it. So from that perspective, because I didn't put any pressure on the podcast because I was putting my pressure everywhere else, it was a lot easier. But it's still a lot of work. I've been fortunate to have some great partners. With me from the beginning has been my producer, Rich Johnson, who helps me on the technical end of this. I've had several great co-hosts over the years, but for the past year and a half, it's been Samantha Gemini Stevens. And she does a lot of the work as well. And she actually has helped me also start neonnews.vegas, where we take some of those great interviews that we get on the podcast and we repurpose them so that they can live on a food blog. And that's something I always wanted to do because people who don't listen to podcasts were missing out on some really good news. So it's about getting the right people to help. I mean, that's what I'll say. I just have a great team that either backs me up or is right there by my side when I do it. And as a result, we've been able to keep it going. We haven't missed a week in going on 3 years right now. We're coming up on our 3-year anniversary.
Now, who came up with the title?
I came up with that title and, you know, it's a tribute, of course, to the great Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. We call it Food and Loathing. And in a lot of ways, it's very much a tribute to his lifestyle, because in my younger days, I lived a lifestyle very similar to his. And I approached Las Vegas very similar to how he did when I was much younger. But also it's that gonzo sense of journalism that he created, which was, you know, that you have to go out and you have to be a part of the things that you experience. And believe it or not, after 20 plus years of covering entertainment in Las Vegas, I'm surprised that there are still a handful of people that can cover it from a desk without going out, you know, in the field. And for me, I have that Hunter S. Thompson aesthetic. I think you have to be there. You have to be in the middle of it at all times. So.
You mentioned the Neon Feast, which was obviously more of hard work that setting up than the podcast was. So when did you come up with the idea of the Neon Feast app? And also, I understand you're running a contest right now.
Yeah, right? We're giving away dinner for two at Joël Robuchon. Definitely one of the most expensive meals you'll ever win. But to answer your first question, Neon Feast was an idea I've had for a very long time. I was getting frustrated with the fact that the people who really know what they're talking about when it comes to food writing, not all of them, but most of them were in newspapers, magazines, publications that were old media, that were losing readers every week. We all know old media is going down, 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 down. Then we had these great technology companies that were grabbing eyeballs, but they were crowdsourcing their information. And so, you know, that's like landing in McCarran or Reed Airport and just walking up to the first stranger you know and saying, what's a good steakhouse? Like, yeah, you know, crowdsource is okay, but wouldn't you rather, you know, if you're on the plane, wouldn't you rather call somebody you know who lives in Vegas, somebody who's works in a restaurant, somebody who's on the scene. So that's what I did. I called all my friends. I sent out several times a year, I send out surveys to chefs, restaurant owners, the journalists that I know that are out there all the time exploring, the influencers that I know that are out there all the time exploring. And I say, where do you send your friends and family in these categories? And we've got 100 categories. Where do you go for date night? Where do you go for a taste of old Vegas? You know, all kinds of things like that, down to, you know, where's your favorite Italian on the strip? And I just took the recommendations of these people that I trust. We wrote them up. We organized them in a way that I think is a lot actually easier to use than some of the crowdsourced apps. And we just want to be there to be restaurant recommendations. So if you see an ad pop up, you know, when you're flipping through and you see a Neon Feast ad that says, you know, hungry for hungry near Allegiant Stadium, right? And then you can click on that and we'll tell you where to eat in the neighborhood around Allegiant Stadium. You know, same thing for the Sphere. And, you know, it's just where other people in the industry recommend that you go. And that's pretty much it. So it's the ultimate Vegas insider's guide. But, you know, we do have, of course, you got to make a living, right? So we offer our restaurants. You can't buy your way onto our app, but you can purchase additional features. And one of those features is a photo gallery on your page. So for my restaurants that have added a photo gallery on their page, we're telling anybody between now and June 30th, if you go into one of those restaurants, take a photo of the food, take a photo of the beverage that you're drinking, take a photo of yourself in front of the sign, so there's no purchase necessary. Upload it to their page on my app, and you'll be entered to win a free dinner for two at Joël Robuchon. This is the full tasting menu. We've got one of the wine pairings that we're going to do for you. We're going to pay your restaurant tax. We're going to pay 20% gratuity on top of this. All in all, this is just under $2,000 all in.
Nice.
And all you have to do is upload a slice of pizza from Good Pie or Evil Pie, or go to one of the other 90 plus restaurants that have the photo gallery and just go and upload a picture of yourself standing in front of them, and you'll be automatically entered to win. I should say the restaurants may not choose to add your photo to the gallery once they see it. You know, your photography skills may not be up there, but you've proven that you're there and you're entered to win. And it's dinner at Robuchon. And honestly, I haven't done the full boat at Robuchon probably in 10 years myself. I mean, it's even for those of us who are foodies, this is a special meal.
Robuchon, yeah, it is definitely special. It's not inexpensive. The phenomenon of people taking pictures of their food at restaurants and then uploading it, either posting it on Instagram or X or wherever they want to do it. Usually Instagram is where they put it. Do you think that takes away from the experience of enjoying the food itself because you're busy curating an image of what you think?
I think it takes away from the experience for everybody who's sitting at your table with you. It takes away from my wife's experience. It takes away from my parents' experience. For me, it doesn't. I think
Wait a minute, Al, you're a professional. I'm talking about people that just do it personally.
Right. And personally. No, I think for the person doing it, that's part of how a new generation likes to experience everything. They go to a concert, they take video. They go, you know, whatever they do, they take a video. It's living through your camera. And that's just a generational thing. And so for people who are raised like that, I don't think taking the time to capture it takes anything away from it. Now, we could, of course, argue whether my way, you know, before cameras was more fun than the modern way. But the truth is, the people who were raised of this document everything generation, that's just part of their life. Right. And they like to document everything that they do. And honestly, I mean, in some ways, I think it takes some of the fun out of living in Las Vegas, because I would not want evidence of some of the things I did here during my wild, crazy early days.
Or before Las Vegas, in your case.
Yeah, or even before Las Vegas, right. But I do think, you know, they're going to have greater memories of what they did. And that's just the way that this generation experiences life, which is to make sure that they record it. And I don't think it takes anything at all away from it, no.
Okay, no, that's a good answer. I was curious about that. I don't weigh in one way or the other. I was just curious about how some people tend to maybe overdo it. I do notice, you know, there's that theory about when you observe something, it changes. So if you observe an animal in the wild, their behavior changes if they know they're being observed. And I'm wondering, sometimes I see some quote unquote influencers in restaurants, which come in with the camera guy, the lights, the microphone, They do a whole.
Yeah, you don't want to be seated next to a serious influencer ever because they light the place up like it's a TV studio. And I have honestly asked to be moved away, even from my friends who are influencers. Like, could you seat me on the other side? Because I do not need to be in the middle of this ridiculous lighting situation. But, you know, it's most of these people in this day and age, most of the restaurants know how to invite them in at times when they're not going to be intrusive. And these people are fantastic photographers, you know, and look, some of them honestly don't know anything at all about food. They only know how to take a great photo, and I respect them. And others really, really love food and love it as much as I do. And I enjoy sharing a meal with those people, you know, because they are as in love with it. They just, you know, whereas I use words and I've always been a writer, they are more visually adept. And right. So I love what they do.
I think there's part of it, though, that some people complain about, which is the ones that are larger than life in terms of their performance while they're talking about the food with the lights and the camera and the microphone.
Yeah.
You should always
remember that you're in a restaurant. I mean, I think, you know, that's the key. But I have, honest to God, I have a bigger problem with the chefs who are more interested in catering to the Instagrammers. And I know that they have to, and I understand why they do it. But I have had so many dishes over the years that were my favorite dishes ruined by chefs that wanted to give them more bling, right? Make them look wilder on an Instagram photo, especially desserts that I were like, this dessert was perfect as it is. It didn't need all this stuff over top of it. But, you know, chefs, they are told now to cook for that Instagram camera. And that's a little troubling, but it's part of where we live, you know.
Before I talk to you about the Milk Street radio, which is another interesting thing you're involved in. That's more to my point, is how do you manage to stay on top of all of it? Because as you said, you're Gonzo. So you're in the mix. And at the same time, you're involved with the podcast, the guide, so many other things. And you're also reviewing restaurants and going to events, et cetera. So how does all that work where you don't just say, you know what, I'm taking about a week off and just collapsing?
A week off, that would be nice. I heard about somebody doing that once.
Yeah, they do that.
I don't know. You know, I decided when I left the Review Journal that I was going to put, you know, the next 5 years of my life into really launching Neon Feast. So we're 3 years into that. You know, there are certain points in your life when you go, okay, man, I just have to get really, really serious right now. To me, it was like when I decided to go to law school, you know, and you know that you're going to have to put certain level of the fun aside and that you're not going to be able to do it just for fun. And that's the problem, is I'm not doing anything for fun now. I'm doing them for business. But that's why you get into something you love, so it's more enjoyable. And seriously, just surrounding myself with fantastic people like Rich Johnson, like Gemini Stevens, like everybody who fills out the surveys for me, like the seven or eight or maybe even nine local food writers who help me write the reviews for Neon Feast after the surveys have been filled out. You know, I'm lucky enough that I know the best of the best in this town and that they're willing to work with me. And so, you know, those people help it to continue to happen.
Yeah, no, that it's still a lot of work, no matter the fact that you have a great support system. I mean, it's just, you do get at least 7 hours sleep, don't you? Or maybe not.
You know, I try to force myself to get 7 hours sleep these days. I really do. Yeah. So, because at 56, you can't live on no sleep like you did in your 30s.
Right, exactly. So I mentioned at the beginning, too, about Milk Street Radio Live in Las Vegas. That's going to be hosted by Milk Street founder Christopher Kimball. So at the Beverly Theater, I mentioned June 10th at 6 p.m. You're going to be involved in that. How did that come about for you?
Yeah, I was just really flattered to be contacted by my friends at Milk Street. And I know several people recommended me to them. One of the other women, Chef Jamie Tran, who's going to be on the panel with me. She's one of the people who recommended me to them. And they called and asked if I would like to come into this live show that they're doing and talk about the way that I love the Vegas food scene. Maybe give them some unexpected tips. Maybe tell them a few things that they didn't already know. Could tell them where they should hang out. I don't know. We haven't worked it all out yet. I'm still talking to them about what they want me to provide, but I'm just honored to be a part of it. I mean, Christopher Kimball is a legend in the field of food journalism, you know, a publisher, a TV host, a TV creator. His radio show is heard on 200 PBS stations every week. He also has the podcast version of it. You know, this America's Test Kitchen he helped create. I mean, this is a guy who is just, you know, he's got a few years on me and he's got quadruple the experience that I do. And on a national level. So just being able to be around him and share with him what I feel are some very special things about Las Vegas that not everybody knows, I mean, that's just an honor to be able to be up there on that stage. So I told them whatever they need from me, I'll be there. Just let me know. And so I'm in the midst of preparing. I can't give away too many secrets now, but I know tickets are only $25. You can get them on the Beverly Theater website. And yeah, it's going to be June 10th. Coming out of, by the way, a week and a half of insanity here in Las Vegas for the world's 50 best restaurants, the Revelry Culinary Festival at Wynn Las Vegas, the Indulge Culinary Festival at Resorts World. These are all happening at the same time. MGM's bringing in some of their celebrity chefs for that week. So all this is going to happen from about the 31st all the way through till about the 8th or the 9th. And then on the 10th, as I'm recovering for that, I'm going to go over to the Beverly Theater and talk about Las Vegas dining. So it's going to be a hell of a week and a half coming up, and it's going to be amazing if you're a foodie in Las Vegas.
And there's also Threescore Restaurant Week as well.
Threescore Restaurant Week, right. I forgot about that. I mean, there's so much happening right here, but that's the beauty of being in Las Vegas. We just roll from one event into another event, and there's always culinary festivities happening. And, you know, that's why there's so much to cover. That's why, you know, even though Food and Loathing is a passion project, we still have a lot of news on there. We still get a lot of guests. And that's why we created NeonNews.Vegas to retell those stories. And if you go, if you're interested, by the way, in checking out World's 50 Best Restaurants or Revelry or Indulge, all those festivals happening next week, we did a story on NeonNews.Vegas rounding down which events are open to the public, which ones still have tickets available, all that with links to purchase tickets. We calculated what the prices were for you. You know, when it says $250 a head, but then by the time you buy it, it's more like three and whatever. So we did all that for you over at NeonNews.Vegas.
I have to say, I asked this of a guest recently, and I'd love to ask it of you. We always hear, or we've been hearing for the last 20 years about food scarcity and, the sustainable food and seafood. And somehow Las Vegas, in the middle of the desert, somehow manages to not only have 9 million restaurants, I'm exaggerating, of course, but all of these events that you just referenced. So how does that work? Or have you ever thought about that? How is it that we have an abundance of food when theoretically the world is not
well food? Yeah, I mean, look, once the casinos went all in on fine dining, and you could decide when you think that was, whether it was the opening of Bellagio or maybe the opening of Wynn, but there were certain demarcation lines.
Right.
Once the casinos were all in and they let Bradley Ogden buy over at Caesars, buy from whatever producers he wanted, once all that happened, then the ingredients started to flow to Las Vegas, right? And once they're flowing in for the casinos, everybody can take advantage of that. Right. So what you need is you need that big money buyer. You need the casinos. You need these giant, you know, huge corporations to say, OK, we'll start working with maybe this fish trader in Tokyo to get great sushi fish. And once that stuff all starts rolling into town, then your corner sushi bars have a lot better access because, you know, the people who do the importing, the people who do the transportation to Las Vegas, they don't care who they're selling to. Once they've got the big buyer on the hook, they're going to sell to other people as well. So I think, you know, that buy-in by the casinos just made it so easy for Las Vegas to function as if our restaurateurs are working in a major market, as if they're working in someplace like New York or Los Angeles that has right. lots of great farmers markets and all that. The ingredients just flow right now.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way. The dining scene in Las Vegas, it's not limited to just the big resorts. It's clearly an explosion of dining throughout the valley. And a lot of local restaurants, you mentioned earlier about celebrity chefs, people that have worked with celebrity chefs not wanting to go back to the home office, but starting restaurants on their own. Were you surprised at the explosion of all these local restaurants? And there's generally two areas. There's Summerlin, there's Green Valley in Las Vegas, but there's other areas as well too. But you have a major development of quality food and dining.
Well, that I think that move and that transformation, that was that key moment that I saw that was starting to happen that made me fall in love with this scene, right? So I wasn't surprised by it because it's what kept me intrigued by this scene as I was seeing it happen. And it's been weird to watch where these food pockets pop up, right? Because Summerlin actually developed much more slowly than we expected.
Very slowly,
so
right.
many super fine dining restaurants went into Summerlin and none of them could get a foothold there for 20 years. And then suddenly Harlow popped up in downtown Summerlin and people are willing to go to a steakhouse that is as fancy and as expensive as the places on the strip. And they're willing to do it in downtown Summerlin. everybody thought that Fremont East was going to pop up a lot quicker than it did. And it turned out that Carson Avenue has developed more as the food corridor than Fremont East did. Mm-hmm. And the explosion of the Arts District, to me, that's been one of the most exciting things to watch. And that really is the most recent. And I think that COVID really helped that, believe it or not, because you couldn't go anywhere, but you could go to the Arts District and walk from place to place to place outdoors and sit on different patios. And that really helped that scene explode, right? So we've had them pop up all over. The Chinatown explosions had a lot of different stages. You know, it started with Raku that got national attention for a Japanese restaurant. And then for maybe 6 or 7 years, Chinatown was a great Asian area. But then suddenly Brian Howard opened Sparrow and Wolf in Chinatown, and it wasn't Asian. It wasn't anything that you could describe. It was fine dining. And suddenly people said, wow, Chinatown can be anything. And then we got great Spanish in Chinatown with EDO, tapas. We got great French fine dining in Partage, right? And we started getting more casual things. These have all popped up at different speeds and at different rates than I would have expected. But sitting back and watch it happen has been so much fun. And, you know, you'll see a couple false starts in certain neighborhoods. Right now, what's going on over by the IKEA, right, between having Durango Station open up on one corner or Durango Resort, excuse me, by Station Casinos, open up on one corner, having Uncommons open up on another corner. We're going to have the Bend going in there with some great restaurants. That's turning into a real powerhouse restaurant area. So the cool thing right now is you don't know where the next big place is going to be. There's almost no need to define it because we're in a city where it's still easy to drive around. It doesn't matter if somebody is, you know, 20 minutes away, you can get there pretty easily. So it's just a lot of fun. It's such a fun time right now. You know, there's a new publication that just came out today, actually, called The Town Summerlin. I'm doing Neon Feast is providing restaurant lists for them as well. But, you know, there's just it's a lifestyle magazine for higher income people, et cetera. Those people want to know where to eat right now. And they want to know good, cool places where to eat. They're not looking, not to disparage anybody, but, you know, 20 years ago, P.F. Chang's was the best, you know, most popular restaurant in Summerlin. Right. That's where the rich people went. They liked that. Right. Now they like to go to places that are a little more original, a little more experimental. They want to go to Chinglish, a family-owned restaurant, rather than P.F. Chang's, you know. And I think it's great, man. It's fantastic.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Al Mancini, co-host of the Popular Food and Loathing podcast. It's available on many platforms. He's creator of the Las Vegas dining guide app Neon Feast, which features recommendations by chefs, critics, insiders, and influencers, and available on app stores for both Apple and Android. And he's going to be a special guest on Milk Street Radio, live in Las Vegas, hosted by Milk Street founder Christopher Kimball. That's at the Beverly Theater, June 10th at 6 p.m. And you can follow Al on X and Instagram at Al Mancini Vegas. Now, thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks for your time, man. It's always great to see you.
Same here. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Hey, Las Vegas.